Julian Lodge, welcome to The String.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great treat. Been a fan a long time. You're here between two dates at the Station Inn.
That's right.
Enjoyed the show last night very much.
Thank you so much.
What's a good uptown New York jazz guy doing in the world's greatest bluegrass bar?
Well, that room is obviously epic for the lore that's associated with it, the culture around it. But I first played there actually maybe two or so years ago solo, which wasn't the way it was scheduled. It was supposed to be with Chris Eldridge. We were coming through town. This is his hometown. Mm-hmm. We had this big show lined up at the Station Inn, and he got sick as a dog. I think it was food poisoning. It was terrible. And it was too late to cancel or shift. And so I said, okay, you go home. I'll play this solo. Kind of against, better judge myself. Just I'll do a solo set. And I loved it. It felt so much like, a great jazz club. It felt like the Village Vanguard, but in Nashville. So as we were preparing for the trio touring, we thought, well, let's go back there. That felt perfect. It's kind of cool that it's not a typical jazz location, but it is, it has a rich history of guitar playing.
Absolutely.
Strings, all of that. So it's kind of, we get a kick out of bringing something unorthodox there, and it sounds wonderful to us. And for two nights there, we get to try different things and, kind of, which is actually very much like a jazz club would be back in the day.
Including bringing Bela Fleck on stage for the second set.
That's right.
And you mentioned that you'd known him a long time. So before we get into individual names, what I really wanted to cover in our time together is this place in the Venn diagram where roots music and jazz overlap, and where they overlap for you, what your mental outlook is.
Yeah.
Because you've trafficked in both. You pursue a traditional leaning thing, inspired thing with Critter.
Yeah.
Your jazz composing has elements of fiddle tune and it's highly melodic. Mm-hmm. But I know you've worked with Noam McKelney, I believe, Chris Thiele.
Sure, sure.
So talk just generally about your philosophy about this.
Well, it's very unglamorous. I guess that's the best way to say it. It's kind of like I'm a guitar nerd. I love string instruments. I love that there is a Venn diagram within which the instrument can kind of drift in a number of directions. And from my point of view, it was always kind of driven by education. Not institutional education, but my own pursuit of what's possible, So I started playing blues guitar, and then I started getting into jazz more seriously because people said, well, that's how you get better. You study jazz. I wasn't a jazz, nut. I just wanted to get better at the guitar. So I got into that, and around the same time was when I met David Grisman, who for so many years until recently was a pillar of the Bay Area scene.
Yeah, so for folks to know, you grew up in the Bay Area.
Grew up.
You were a young student, too. You were on the radar by 11 and 12
years
old.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So that's right. I was doing it pretty young. And someone like David Grisman was, the embodiment of that Venn diagram you're talking about. He already cracked that code a long time ago. Yeah. And he introduced me to Bela around the same time. So I would have been 11 years old, 12 years old. But also, I remember David bringing me to play with Doc Watson backstage or hang out with Del McCurry. It was all kind of the same thing as far as how it was presented to me through David's eyes. Mm-hmm. And then in short order, I kind of got more serious with jazz, started playing with Gary Burton, the vibraphone master, and he became a mentor for me for many years. Mm-hmm. But all to say, it just never seemed unusual to combine them. Then as I've played longer, I do hear this kind of discourse about it being unusual. How do you do it, or how do you connect it, or why are these things connected? To me, they just seem to share a community of open-minded, progressive people, and that's the bottom line. And I actually think there's a third part of that Venn diagram, which is kind of the avant-garde, there's a lot of similarities between the avant-garde community internationally, also with the acoustic community and with the traditional jazz community. They all share this kind of fringe existence, and all of those have tributaries into bluegrass and trad music and blues and everything else mm-hmm. in American culture.
And, of course, a heavy improvisational aspect to bluegrass music. The soloist steps forward, is supported by the group. And I recognized that so early on, and I was so fascinated. And I've been on this many-year quest to try to shake the world up and go, hey, recognize this.
Yeah, good for you.
Let me pause on the Gary Burton story quickly because, to me, this is the great vibraphone player and band leader. And I love the little parallel that he mentored and brought into his fold Hank Garland.
Yes.
The other way around. When Gary was a very young man coming out of Indiana, Hank Garland invites him to Nashville to be in his band.
Yeah.
And as a result, winds up participating in one of the nearly great jazz, a jazz career cut short in Hank Garland's accident in the 60s. But the idea of Gary Burton finding his way while doing hillbilly record sessions in Nashville.
Exactly. So. Gary I used to bug him about that because I thought that was so cool. My teacher, Randy Vincent, in California, turned me on to that great Hank Garland record that Gary's on. I think Gary's 17 and they do Move and they just, it's incredible. It's so good. And so I knew about that maybe even before I knew about Gary as a leader. You know, I would have been 8, 9, 10 years old.
That's great.
And but then when I joined Gary's band and we were together a lot, Hank Garland's name would come up. Also, Chet Atkins would come up because Chet kind of mentored Gary too when he was in town. He moved from Indiana to Nashville. That was kind of his first step. And then eventually went to, Boston and New York. But it was so comforting because, again, here's another instance where I was around a mentor who would talk about someone like Hank Garland in the same breath that they would talk about Duke Ellington. It wasn't framed as, well, this is Southern and this is not legitimate. It was kind of, no, this was exhilarating, exciting, curious music being made. Mm-hmm. And Hank also, as far as, and everyone probably who knows about Hank knows about this, but one thing that I found interesting that Gary shared with me was just his ingenuity as a conceptualist.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, Hank wasn't doing what he did by accident. I think he understood what it represented to be versed in the Southern kind of music trajectory and combining that with bebop language. You know, that was a vision. Then you fast forward a little bit, Gary Burton's doing that with rock and roll and jazz, or you look at Miles. So, and then in my life, I look at people like Baylor or Grisman or, so on. So there's a lot of masters of fusion, not in a stylistic sense, but just in a conceptual mm-hmm. sense, and it absolutely traces back to Hank and Chet.
Mm-hmm. Magnificent. I raised the names Chris Thiele and Noam Pikelny from Punch Brothers and Critters in that band as well. Mm-hmm. Talk about your relationship with that scene before we get into the recent record with Critter.
Absolutely. I first met Thiele when I was doing that record Sounding Point you mentioned,
okay.
and I wanted, it was my debut record on a label, and I wanted something that represented maybe a side that wasn't so obvious to my jazz constituents, which was that I had this background through acoustic string music. So I called Bela and I said, would you be into doing a few songs? He said, yes, to my surprise. And I said, I want to get Thiele on it, but I don't know him. He said, well, let me call him and, kind of kick the tires a little bit. So anyway, from Bela calling Thiele, Thiele agreed to do it. And we got together a couple times, wrote some music. I met Chris at a Punch Brothers show when I was living in Boston at the time. And obviously, Critter was there, Chris Eldridge. And while I was waiting for Thiele to get off duty or whatever, I went back and just started playing with Critter. And it was kind of a love at first sight thing. We played a fiddle tune. We thought, wow, this is really cool. This is really something. And we kind of vowed to make a to-do out of it. It took years, Okay. We eventually had to put something on the calendar, which was how we tend to operate. But say, look, we get together twice a year. We always have a blast. Let's make a record. Let's put a tour. We probably made a tour first, and then before we, embarked on it, we went and recorded some things so we could sell it at the shows. But that had its own life kind of simultaneous to playing with Chris and Bela. Then Noam is someone I've played with mostly in the context of Punch Brothers, or American Acoustic Tour that we did. We did one thing at Berkeley together that was kind of a trio with Alex Hargraves, and that was the most stripped-down thing I've done with Noam. But, in short order, this became a community I associated with just because we're all kind of trying to get better and work on our craft. So I feel very close to them and grateful to them for just, I don't know, looking out for me and including me. They don't have to. I'm the outlier.
Well, no, I see y'all's personality jiving. I can see, right. Musical outlook and skill sets and the ability to listen and quickly pick up on what you're each, strong at and
right.
love to do and express yourself. So it doesn't surprise
Thanks,
me at man. All.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
This is, I think I'm finally seeing the something galvanizing around this new American string-based
right.
Thing that we're talking now about artists. I think if we'd been some years ago, there might have been, Chris and Nickel Creek had some notoriety on CMT.
Sure.
The public radio has always treated this scene pretty well, but like, now at the festival level, now at these really lovely performing arts centers and internationally, stuff that was spawned by certainly Grisman and Sam Bush and the Newgrass scene.
Absolutely.
The Colorado situation has gone bonkers.
Yeah.
And what I'm excited by is that it's continued to pull in some really sophisticated thinking and high level music making.
Right.
It's not just a jam grass party. That's great too.
Absolutely.
But the people seem to be feeding off each other's intellectually and just very intensely. So, what do you see going on?
I'm kind of in it as far as being a student of it. So I it's hard for me to zoom out. But I do have to say that there's something about the nature of these instruments, string music in general, that is frankly very portable and very practical.
Sure.
We're talking about a kind of music that can exist at the highest level and have the most impact in a, with people huddled in a circle. It can be on a stage. It can be in a recording studio. It's very portable in its presentation, which you can't necessarily be said for, a symphony orchestra or even certain types of rock jazz bands, or there is something genuinely pragmatic about the whole thing. I think you combine that with the fact that we're standing on the shoulders of all these giants, like you said, like Dog or Sam or any Bela, Tony Rice, all these people.
Yeah.
And you combine it with just a general shift in, I think, music appreciation towards unorthodox ways. In many respects, I think it's a really beautiful time for music because there are things that are slightly niche or slightly subculture-y that are able, like you're saying, to be put on a main stage. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the doing of any one group of people. I think it's just kind of, for lack of a better word, inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the nature of it. I mean, jazz experienced that too. There was a period where jazz was kind of one general thing as far as what it represented in culture. If you're looking at early 20s, teens, 30s, it was unusual, it was fringe, it was New Orleans, it was Oklahoma, there was, but it became this real American treasure once people around the country knew about it. So I think every genre does this. I think we just happen to be in a renaissance of the string thing, but I don't think it's, I like to think that it's not unusual. I'd like to think that it's almost innate.
Well, there's the fact that you can see a Kamasi Washington selling a lot of tickets to young people. There are things breaking through in jazz. Do you think that your own sort of sense of career prospects have shifted? And what do you feel like you're coming for? Where are you coming from? Ambitious. Mm-hmm. We're sitting in your management's office.
Right. So, I have a manager.
So you're supposed to be, they're listening. You're supposed to be ambitious.
Yeah.
What would you like to achieve?
Well, it's a great question. I have a personal, feeling about the concept even of ambition and career, and I sometimes think they're kind of dirty words. Not that they implicate anything that's not pure. I just think there's a lot of constructs that come into play that define a career that are very much left of center as far as what the mission is. They work well with it. Or you say, okay, this is the music I want to create. These are the people I care about and I want to work with. And this is the kind of job I would pay to do. I would do whatever it takes to do it, even if it was completely, in my bedroom and no one heard it. It's a gift to be able to be involved with it. So that's the starting point.
Yeah.
It's about community. Beyond that, there's a economic infrastructure that you want to you know, have your own healthy relationship with. And for me, like I said, I feel a bit spoiled. I grew up seeing people like Grisman. I saw people like Bailey. I saw people like Gary. I saw people like Jim Hall, all of whom did their thing, you know? And I think there was such a degree of sincerity to what they did from the earliest point that just on a human level, people responded. You know, it wasn't simply because they had the right manager, the right label, or even right time. I think they really, I don't know, they just did their thing and it kind of worked out to varying degrees. Mm-hmm. So, and then another, someone I work a lot with and someone I cherish very dearly is John Zorn, who's kind of the, I mean, he's such an archetype in so many ways for, and a hero in the, what you might call the more avant-garde world of music.
Okay, or, that's fair to say.
Yeah. Well, it runs the spectrum. It's every, it's really everything. We have a project that's just Renaissance guitar music. We have a project that's shred metal, two electric guitars, bass and drums. And a whole lot of other configurations. But someone like Zorn is a great example of someone who really kind of built a community geographically in New York. And to me, that's maybe, if there's any ambition, it's that. Mm. Is that you can live in a community of people that you not only respect and admire, that's important, but that you actually fuel, that your success, in whatever terms you may define it, actually helps them. In the case of Zorn, he writes, you know, he just wrote 300 songs and started 30 bands and gave each of them 10 songs and then mounted tours around the world doing 30 groups of musicians, you know, for everyone from Rabot to Mary Halverson to Tyshawn Sorey. And you just go, that is so badass. So to me, my dream is that whatever we are able to achieve progress-wise positively affects our peers.
You, when you made the Arclight record 2 years ago and then the new Modern Lore, you shifted gears from a lot of projects that were solo or duo to the trio with bass and drums and a Telecaster guitar.
That's right.
And that made me real happy. Just my personal
both.
Taste.
Yeah.
But what did shift? What was that journey about?
Well, I appreciate you asking. That was, you know, deliberate, super deliberate. I started as a blues guitar player. You know, I played with my dad. He played Telecaster. I've had a Stratocaster. And, you know, Muddy Waters, T-Bone Walker, Stevie Ray Vaughan. That was my lens, you know, for the guitar. And then almost more out of practicality, I started playing jazz boxes. I started playing at certain volumes. I started learning the instrument from the perspective of jazz guitar, modern jazz guitar. And I love it. That's so dear to me. But I was running into certain limitations. I would feel like the archtop guitar for the kind of music I played actually didn't sound the way I wanted it when I put it next to a bass and a drums, and when I wrote music for them to be at a certain volume. So in other words, I felt like I was kind of the weak link in these bands. I had a band, cello, that Sounding Point band was, first record was cello, tenor saxophone, acoustic bass, percussion, and acoustic guitar. And I was the quietest thing in the band. But if I was any louder, everything else seemed really kind of was overshadowed by it. So there was a struggle. And I thought, well, what instrument is innately designed to be plugged in and inherently, you know, good at this? And that led me back to where I started, electric guitar. Okay. And the Telecaster, as far as frequency range goes, is pretty neutral. You know, we think of it as twangy, we think of it as bright, but that is kind of how guitars sound. Guitars tend to not have a ton of bass unless something's happening to it. They tend to have a cap on their brightness. They're not infinitely bright or high. So I thought, if I can make this sound the way I want, I'll probably be better for it. And the irony is I can play a lot lighter and quieter now that I have the assistance of an amplifier and a solid body guitar.
Yeah. That what kept striking me last night, I thought about it on the records too, but in the live setting, really, that one of your absolute great strengths is, I would put it, I have to use the word shading.
Yeah, yeah.
That there's not a note that isn't begun with some sort of deliberate notion about how it's attacked, and then the way it decays, the way it plays into the next one. And there's so this really granular level where you're, where I don't know, you're thinking about it, but you're certainly executing on it and taking advantage of the tonal, both the light touch that the Telecaster has, but that a little bit of energy just goes a long way.
It's exponential. Yeah. You're right. I mean, that blows my mind. And it's a work in progress. I my nerves will get the best of me and I'll play harder than I want to. But when done the way I crave, it's like, it's this one note is a multi-stage experience. You know, it's kind of, there's the attack, there's the rise and fall, there's the decay, there's what you do with it in terms of inflection. And all of that, only it doesn't really matter in and of itself, but the way I think it contributes is that it has a potential to make the other instrument sound as great as they can. You know, if I'm just stiff as a cardboard cutout, I'm kind of a guitar sitting on a rhythm section. But if I have any ability to shade it like we're talking about, I notice that I notice the same properties with the bass. I hear it in his fingers. I hear it in the fretboard. I hear the same qualities between sticks and brushes and cymbals and drums. So it is kind of like you're right, it's granular, but it's an ensemble-wide consideration. And I'm just part of the ensemble.
You also seem to take great delight at being in that. You're one of those tightrope walkers. You are so in the moment. I'm curious where and when you began to get comfortable being in such a risky place at any given second, and if there was a mentor or a teacher, or if it was just sheer accumulated experience. But you don't play it safe, and you figure out a way. Sometimes I see you laughing at yourself.
Yeah,
when something either goes. You sort of figure out something out that you maybe weren't planning that worked out, or you get something clever or something that just didn't
go over.
And I love that.
I love it too. I mean, to me, that's Jim Hall. I mean, really? Jim Hall. Oh my God, yeah. Jim was the master of that. I mean, Jim's premise was...
Folks, know this name.
Yeah, Jim
Hall.
Know
this name. That very simple name, Jim Hall. Is a genius beyond description.
He is the greatest. I consider him the father of modern jazz guitar. Yeah. You know, he is to what we do as, you know, Picasso was to visual art. It was this other dimension. It wasn't purely incredible, which it was. Jim had a sense of humor. And I think the tightrope thing was something that he thought of as being implicit in the job we do. You know, if you even think for 2 seconds about an improviser's responsibility or what we're doing, it's not long before you realize that it's absurd. It's ridiculous. It's not even, it's just kind of like, what are you doing over there? You're kind of sometimes stumbling through the dark and you're trying things out. So rather than treating it as this, you know, holy thing that you have to be perfect at, Jim kind of had a way of being an instigator. He would play something. He would wait. He'd listen. He'd see what effect it had on the band. He would then make another decision based on what he heard. And this cycle would just kind of continue and become very charged in a way that you couldn't necessarily get to if you were just the person who's in charge playing great thing after great thing. And Jim was so stealthy. He was so stealthy. And I played with him a fair amount, and that was something I felt being by his side, is he could get you, if you were trying to play it safe, he would somehow force you on that tight rope. Wow. He'd just do it in this way where he would throw you off. And anyway, so I mean, there's such a precedent, is my point. You know, I even get the sense that Django was like that too. If you listen to a lot of Django Reinhardt, it's become memorialized as this vocabulary that we all know, and there's licks and phrases, not licks to him, but to us, we can do it. But when you really, whenever I listen to him, I think that he's kind of on the seat of he's just bare, like things are landing, they're very graceful, he's very elegant, but he's not conservative. So again, I'm only doing it because everyone did it before me, but I do try to heighten it, and the people I play with in my band do that respectively on their instruments. So I'm more inclined to do what you're talking about because they're doing the same thing on the bass and the drums.
It was a stellar band. Aren't they great? Did not know those folks before. So it's Jorge Roeder.
Jorge Roeder and Eric Dube. Yeah, Eric Dube on drums. Two of my favorites.
So just to wrap up here, Julian, where are we heading? Where do you see here?
Well, there's, you know, God willing, there's a few projects I have in the works right now. And that's kind of, as we've rolled out this new record, those other things are kind of next in line. So there's a duo project with Steve Swallow, one of my heroes and just favorite musicians in the world that we've been cultivating for a while. There's other things with the current band, which mm-hmm. is a bit of a transition to the new personnel and new music. There's some stuff that's just me that I'm working on, just solo, kind of continuing the thread of a solo record I did called World's Fair,
right.
but in a very different way. And then a lot of Zorn projects. We just did a Masada record, which is a series of, he's written up, I think, 900 something songs, using these Jewish scales called, and the program's all under the auspices of Masada. So I'm involved with one of those, and like I said, the metal thing, and actually a bunch of Zorn things. So I'm just kind of working, trying to get everything up and running, so that we can get stronger and, you know, I don't know. That's, and spread the word. That's really it.
We will watch with great interest.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate this.
Thank you, sir.